We're set. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the February 5th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll, Carla?
Yes. Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Novick?
Here.
Hales?
Here. Welcome, everyone. We appreciate your attendance tonight. This is going to be a hearing in which we're taking up one subject, but we're taking it up with two alternatives, a little bit of an unusual way for us to proceed into an issue. One of the reasons why we're doing that is this is an issue where there are very strong arguments and very strong feelings on both sides. And the purpose of this hearing is to get the staff to present the issue to us and then to hear from people that have those strong feelings and strong opinions. And we're going to do that in this way. We're going to call up a panel of city employees, first of all. Then we're going to call up a panel that are here to speak in favor of the Portland's participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And then we're going to call up a panel of folks who believe that is not the right way to proceed. And then we'll open it up to public testimony. So we have some invited testimony up front and public testimony to follow that. As always in this chamber, but particularly, again, on an issue where there are strong feelings, we want to respect our fellow citizens' point of view. So if you agree with someone and want to demonstrate support, feel free to give them a thumbs up or waves of the hand, but we ask that we not make vocal demonstrations in favor or against our fellow citizens' opinions, because this should be a chamber where all those opinions get heard. So we have two different versions of this resolution before us tonight. I'll ask Carla to read those, and then I'll call up the first panel.
Okay. 146 and 147.
Yes, please. Okay.
146. The City of Portland shall not enter into a memorandum of understanding with the Federal Bureau of Investigation related to the work of the Joint Terrorism Task Force and shall repeal binding city policy BCP-PSF-7.01. And item 147, the City of Portland shall enter into a memorandum of understanding to become a member of the local Joint Terrorism Task Force in conjunction with the Federal Bureau of Investigation and shall repeal binding city policy BCP-PSF-7.01.
All right, thank you. So I want to first call up Dave Wobrow from the City Attorney's Office, Deanna Wesson-Mitchell from my staff, and our Chief of Police, Larry O'Day, for a staff presentation, and we'll take it from there.
Hello, Commissioners. Hi. I'm Deanna Wesson-Mitchell, and I'm a policy director for Mayor Hales.
Raise your mic up just a little bit, Deanna.
Sorry.
There we go.
All right. What I'm doing today is just going to provide a summary of what the two resolutions are that are going to be before you. And they're both based off of the existing policy, which was done in 2011 with a lot of community involvement, months of community input and government work together to figure out how to do a partial case-by-case relationship with the Joint Terrorism Task Force, with the Portland Police Bureau involved only on a case-by-case basis. So after a significant and well-documented community collaborative effort, this compromise, the 2011 current resolution, was achieved. Some of the issues that the compromise addressed were community and governmental concerns about access to terrorist threat investigations and detailed information that could be received only by joining the JTTF, an increase in the capacity of the JTTF through support of PPB officers, investigative procedures and policies under federal laws and policies, which were also a concern. The resolution address concerns that PPB officers, if we entered into a memorandum of understanding, would be outside of the standard chain of command on day-to-day operational matters. There is also a concern about the level of access to information regarding the activity of the police bureau officers who were assigned to the JTTF, and then differences in the interpretation specifically of ORS 181575 and ORS 181850, which address how the government Oregon law regarding government's involvement in people's immigration status or investigations of immigration status, and also the ability to collect information on people in Oregon. So those are the Oregon laws, specific Oregon laws that were of great concern. So implementing the case-by-case membership relationship with JTTF has not proved possible with the current, with the way that the JTTF is structured. So our current participation level, these two resolutions, if the council decides to go with the resolution that does not enter into a memorandum of understanding, it will pretty much maintain the current status and participation level of the police bureau with JTTF. So right now, the policy says that the police bureau can be involved on an as-needed basis, but that hasn't really worked out, and so the police bureau is currently not a member of the JTTF and does not assign officers on a full-time basis. When the resolution was developed in 2011, there was a hope that officers could be assigned possibly for multiple months at a time, but that has not worked out to be possible. We do have a lot of five other specific coordinated efforts with the FBI that are working successfully. Those include the Innocent Images, the Bank Robbery Task Force, the Metro Gang Task Force. We want to highlight that we have success. The police bureau has successful partnerships with the FBI. Currently, the situation is if the FBI, they will notify the Portland Police Bureau should a JTTF investigation lead to knowledge of an immediate threat here in Portland. That is currently the situation that we're in. Also, the police chief is required under the current policy to gain a FBI Secret Service clearance so they can participate in the JTTF Executive Board, and that would continue with the resolution to not enter into a memorandum of understanding. The other current members of the local the Executive Board include police chiefs and sheriffs from Beaverton, Clackamas, Gladstone, Hillsborough, Milwaukee, Multnomah County, and Tigard. So those participation in that executive board will continue, and they meet periodically to go over with the terrorist threats to the region and updates for leaders of local police agencies. Another thing that will continue under the resolution you have before you today to remain out of the JTTF would be that the police commissioner and the chief will continue to receive biannual briefings from the FBI special agent in charge. These cover updates on activities that the FBI and the Portland Police Bureau currently have task force together, including the Metro Gang Task Force and the other ones that were listed earlier. They'll also include summaries or general updates regarding current issues around terrorist activity nationally, internationally, and regionally, but it won't deal with specifics regarding what's going on in Portland. The difference with the resolution to stay out of the MOU, it would discontinue the requirements for the police commissioner to seek a secret level FBI clearance, because that is currently not the general policy for the FBI to issue that to an elected official who is not also a sworn law enforcement officer. And it would discontinue the public reports, which have been highly unsatisfactory to people because of their vagueness and the lack of information that is in those reports. So that is kind of the basics of what is in the resolution that would say that we're not going to join join an MOU to join the JTTF. And it basically maintains and clearly states what the current situation is as far as the relationship that we have. So then the other resolution before you is also based off of the 2011 resolution very closely. We really wanted to honor all of the time and effort that went into developing that resolution. So if this is the resolution that the council decides to go with, then it will allow Portland Police Bureau to become full-time members with the three other current local agencies. The Oregon State Police, Port of Portland Police, and the Washington County Sheriff's Office are currently full-time members of the JTTF. This resolution has several of the additional safeguards that were established in 2011, including the Portland Police Bureau assigned officers' responsibilities. We would assign two officers to the JTTF full-time. There would be under the day-to-day operational command chain of command of the JTTF as they would be located in the FBI offices. However, they would still be responsible to uphold the same Oregon and local laws, regulations, and policies that are applicable to all Portland police officers. Chief O'Day is going to give more details on what that structure would look like. The other Portland Police Bureau Portland officer responsibilities that are in the resolution require them to participate in an annual training with the city attorneys to make sure that they fully understand and are able to comply with current state and federal laws. If they are ever asked to do something while they are over, or they're doing the work with the JTTF that is outside of Oregon or local laws, they would be required to notify the special agent in charge and the police chief, especially concerning ORS laws 181575 and ORS 181850. If an officer who's assigned to the JTTF ever has a question regarding how to apply an Oregon law, they would be required to seek the legal advice from the city attorney's office. And the city attorney's office responsibilities in this resolution, they would be required to consult with the officers if they ever have concerns, obtain a non-disclosure agreement with the FBI if they needed to obtain classified information in order to provide accurate advice to the officers. And they would also be required to notify the police commissioner and chief if they could not obtain enough information to provide accurate advice to the police officers who came to them with questions. Then it would be leadership's responsibility to seek a resolution with the FBI regarding that matter. So the city attorneys would also be responsible to provide annual training to the officers, and confer annually with the Oregon Attorney General regarding any possible changes to laws or policies which would preclude PPB officers from legally working with the JTTF. That would be an annual written statement they would do. And then the police chief's responsibilities would be to adopt publicly available administrative policies and procedures consistent with the resolution, continue their participation in the JTTF executive board, obtain top secret clearance to allow them to receive regular briefings from PPB staff, and immediately notify the police commissioner of any report from officers assigned to the JTTF that they had been asked to or something they were doing was in a violation of law. The police chief would also be responsible to participate in the quarterly classified FBI briefings with the police commissioner. And this is a new one that is in this current resolution that will hopefully address some of the concerns if the council decides to enter into a memorandum of understanding. The FBI has agreed to, the FBI has agreed to enter into a non-disclosure agreement with the police commissioner, the mayor, and provide quarterly classified briefings regarding activities of the Portland Police Bureau officers who are assigned to the JTTF. This would replace the request for a secret clearance, which wasn't going to actually happen. So the other change with, in addition to no longer asking for secret clearance, there would not be an annual public report with if we entered into a memorandum of understanding, because the reports would, there is a difference in the federal public records laws, and reports would be property of the FBI. So we would, if we were doing an annual report, it would continue to be very unsatisfactory to people by what the amount of information that was able to be shared publicly. So that is where the non-disclosure agreement with the police commissioner would enable the police commissioner to have those classified briefings. And if ever they found that they were not able to have enough information from the FBI about what the officers were involved in, there is the ability for the police commissioner to withdraw officers from the JTTF, and city council could move to terminate the MOU with 60-day notice. That's in standard in the MOU. So that's kind of a summary of the two resolutions. Again, they're both very closely based off of the 2011 resolution that was developed with a lot of input. But they could both of those would be able to be fully operationalized by the police bureau and city attorney's office to make them an actuality.
Great. Thank you, Deanna. Thanks very much. Questions for Deanna before Dave takes the next segment? Okay.
Good evening, Mayor, Commissioners. David Wober with the city attorney's office. Let me take a minute and get a little PowerPoint up here. I can help you with three things this evening. I've been asked to, I can help you with the history, how we've managed the relationship, the various configurations of resolution and MOU we've had over the years. If you have particular questions about that, that can be very detailed. I won't go into it at first. I'm also the person that's monitored some of our criminal intelligence unit activities, and I'm familiar with dealing with sensitive information, legal review of sensitive information. I would likely be the person charged with taking questions from officers should you pass that resolution. First of all, though, I am going to present the MOU itself. You needed a lawyer to actually go through the MOU and lay out what it does and what it doesn't do. It is 17 pages long, so I've organized it by three issue areas that I've seen perennially when this is discussed. The characteristics of this thing that are at issue, the purpose of the investigations. There is often a question about who determines the purpose of the investigations, and are they doing that with the interests of Portland at heart? Secondly, use of investigative tools. Are our officers contributed to JTTF given access to investigative tools not available to them under the Oregon Constitution and Oregon case law? And then finally, this issue of access to information for management. So I've used these three issue areas to kind of pull apart the MOU, and I'm going to show you some of the particulars in the MOU that address these things. There's a general statement on page one about the purpose announced by the federal government for the JTTF. And of course, after 9/11, there was considerable concern about the lack of coordination between various law enforcement agencies, and the stated goal by the federal government is to facilitate sharing of information with the locals and all people involved in anti-terrorism activities. And at the bottom, underlined, you see that there's an acknowledgement that this must be done in a manner that preserves constitutional rights and civil liberties. Again, mission statement on page one. Information sharing, again, emphasized by the MOU. The MOU doesn't say exactly what the rules are, but it lists many, many documents and sources of regulation that the federal government applies to these kinds of investigations. It's an extensive list. There's two pages here. I'll give you some time to absorb it. The federal investigators are rule-bound. They have many, many layers of oversight. I'm sure people will talk today about whether that's effective or not, but they have way more oversight than we can imagine here in Portland. Layers and parallel responsibilities. And here are some more of those controlling documents to which the people on the JTTF would be subject, our people as well as the federal people. To burrow into what gets talked about almost every time this comes up, I've got here for you the Oregon statute that addresses criminal intelligence gathering and prohibits essentially spying on the social activities and associational activities of the public. ORS 181575 was enacted back in the 80s in response to abuses by criminal intelligence units in this state, and prohibits law enforcement agencies from collecting or maintaining information without, and I'll shorten this up, without a criminal predicate. I apply this to the information I receive from officers regularly. Criminal predicate is essential in Oregon to apply any investigative tools when there may be associations at issue. The federal language, it's more extensive, and the reason I showed you the documents is that it's the rules are kind of spread through all sorts of regulatory tools. But this is what the federal government has provided us in the past in as a statement of their principle in drawing the line between investigations that pursue a criminal problem and investigations that may be interested only in associational activities, political beliefs, things, the religious beliefs. So the Attorney General guidelines are from the federal government. The Privacy Act is a federal government document. It is clear from this language in the MOU that the JTTF is controlled by the federal government. The overall commander of each individual JTTF will be the special agent in charge. The chain of command is quite clear and laid out in the MOU. FBI policy runs the JTTF. And there is a provision in the last sentence there for the last paragraph for resolving conflicts that arise between the operational units in the field. It's expected, of course, every once in a while you're going to have questions and perhaps get different answers from the chain of command, and there's a resolution mechanism. Now, I believe this is a change that happened somewhere around 2007, 8, 9, somewhere in there. The federal government recognized that people contributed by local agencies to a JTTF would be bound by their personnel rules, laws, and policies. And the second paragraph there talks about what will happen if there is a conflict. So while the chain of command is quite clearly defined as federal, the personnel rules and policies of the local agency do play a role in managing the activities of the contributed employees.
Do we know when that was added?
I can't say with specificity. I can find out.
Was it in the MOU that we took up in a few years ago?
Yes. I think this has been in place since then, yes. All right. So that's, you know, who directs the JTTF? Well, the federal government does. There's accommodation for policy control over the people that you contribute and extensive overlay of oversight. Use of investigative tools used to be, for me, a tough issue. It involved a lot of case law having to do with particular tools, and there were differences between Oregon search and seizure rules handed down by the courts is an interpretation of Article 1, Section 9 of our Constitution, and the Fourth Amendment rulings by the federal courts. That gap has narrowed considerably over the years, and there's not much left to it. In fact, it might have actually flipped the other way. The principal tool that I could think of in the past that was available to federal investigators, not available to Oregon investigators, was the ability to place a tracker, a vehicle tracker, in a car without a warrant. A pretty powerful tool. It was available to the federal investigators, not to our people, unless they were deputized and acting in the federal capacity. We had a case a few years ago that ended that for the federal government. Federal government now, their employees, their investigators, and JTTF people are required to get warrants in order to place trackers. The one difference I can think of now, I spotted just the other day, it has to do with mere conversation, where the federal rule of consensual or mere conversation contacts between investigators and people on the street is actually more generous to law enforcement in the federal system. In Oregon than in the federal system. So we have something of a reversal. From my point of view, as a lawyer watching this for years, this issue shouldn't be as much in play. There's not much difference any longer. Access to information for management is, of course, of great concern. The JTTF MOU requires that the people that you contribute apply for and receive top secret sensitive compartmented information security clearance. from the FBI. And of course, as participants in the JTTF are strictly forbidden from releasing information except in conformance with federal regulations. An important part of the conversation that we don't explore fully every time is the need to know. You have to have a appropriate security clearance plus need to know to receive information. This seems draconian to some, but in any law enforcement activity, and I'll refer to this again a couple of slides, for instance, a homicide case, these are typical rules. Need to know is a dominant guide in management of information in criminal investigations, whether they're JTTF, Portland Police Bureau's Fraud Division, Homicide Division, whatever. It's pretty typical for law enforcement to manifest here in this language. The records of the activities of JTTF belong to JTTF, not to the city. They'll be maintained by the FBI. The FBI will regulate disclosure. Again, this seems there's strong language here. The FBI has taken control, as do we. For instance, if we have a joint homicide investigation with Beaverton, we will maintain those records and require Beaverton to turn to us if there's a request for the records and Portland makes the decision on release. And that's what I have for you.
Thank you. Questions for David at this juncture? Okay, then let's turn to you, Chief. Thank you very much for being here tonight.
Bet. Thank you for your thoughtful consideration regarding city participation in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. A decision like this requires a robust and thoughtful discussion as we balance a responsibility that we both share regarding maintaining a safe city and maintaining trust in our government and our police. I appreciate the thoughtfulness you're given in making this important decision and in preserving both of these principles. And I'm not here to pound on the table and tell you that Portland's going to be in grave danger if we have no involvement in the Joint Terrorism Task Force, because that's not what I believe, and it's not what I think will occur. If we're not part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the FBI is going to continue doing its investigations without any of our involvement, any of our information, or any of our influence. We'll be notified of an impending event or action, but it's going to likely be, minutes or hours before that event is supposed to occur. And we will have had no ability to influence or impact the investigation, and we'll have to live with and manage with whatever or however they have decided to best proceed without our assistance. If Portland is a part of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, we'll be aware of what investigations are going on in our community and be able to infuse Portland values, assistance, and influence into these investigations. I believe our influence can help not only provide an increased amount of trust, but also provide for more timely, accurate, and thoughtful outcomes. For example, the Portland Police Bureau robustly works with our behavioral health unit when we're making determinations into investigations where there's threats involved. That allows us to much more appropriately determine if a criminal investigation and prosecution is appropriate, or maybe something else. It may be that simply connecting somebody who may be mentally ill and acting out with the appropriate services achieves the best and just outcomes appropriate for our community. Also, by working together and sharing information between agencies, we are much more efficient and knowledgeable. We have the ability to connect a lot of dots working together, and our situational awareness is much greater. This is especially important during these increasingly concerning times. We already currently and effectively partner with the FBI in the Regional Computer Forensics Lab, the Metro Gang Task Force, the Bank Robbery Task Force, and the Child Exploitation Task Force. If you do decide that Portland is to participate, I'm very confident in the level of oversight, influence, control, and access that I and the mayor would have to protect our interests and fully comply with Oregon law. You never want to make decisions like this based on personalities either, but know that Special Agent in Charge Greg Bretzing is a very different special agent in charge. He's been very transparent, opened his doors to me, answered every question that I've had, and he's the first special agent in charge that I've talked to who wants to prioritize community outreach and relationship building for the FBI. Thank you for your thoughtful consideration as you balance our shared priorities of keeping our city safe and ensuring our community has trust in its government and its police. Know that I and the Police Bureau are here to fully support whichever direction you ultimately choose to the very best of our abilities.
Thanks, Chief. So let me pose a couple of questions at the outset here with this panel to you, particularly, Chief, and that is that Deanna and Dave just went through this requirement that if we were to participate in the JTTF, our officers would be required to disclose to you and to me if they had concerns about violation of law or policy. Given a situation like this where they were, in effect, under another chain of command, what incentive would they have, what reassurance would they have, those officers, that they would follow? What incentive would they have to go ahead and do that, to say, hey, Chief, I've got a problem here, as opposed to keeping silent about it?
I think the approach to take with that, I've given a lot of thought to who and how I would assign, and that's why you're hearing the number two. You're not hearing one officer. I'm not going to send one officer over there to disappear in a task force. I'm going to send two officers over there who will have the right personalities, the right training from the city attorney, very clear directions, expectations, and support from me. By having two over there, they can talk to each other. The lieutenant that oversees them, though they'll be a part of the chain of command for investigations that the FBI is in charge of, they will have regular and weekly contact with their lieutenant, who also has the same clearance. I meet with that lieutenant once a week.
Okay. All right. That's helpful. And then another question, sort of a little broader scope. What other benefits do you see accruing to the Portland Police Bureau or to us as a community of participating, aside from the fact that we might be more effective at actually dealing with real potential terrorist threats? What other do you see any other potential benefits?
I do. I see that just by having the ability to share information, it's going to increase the body of knowledge that we have. I think it's also going to increase the ability and access to various training when you're partnered with many of the federal agencies, such as the ones I talked about earlier. That also gets you access to additional training opportunities to better improve your workforce as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Other questions, please.
Thank you, Mayor. Chief, if we are, quote, all in, you'll have to make a decision about staffing and budget.
Yes, sir.
And you said your preference is two officers, a sergeant in the configuration. And so could you give us a sense of what burdens that would place on you and the organization to dedicate those three individuals, both in terms of other kinds of things that you couldn't do and any budget impact?
Yeah, I would be looking at doing this with no additional cost. What I would be doing this out of existing resources that I'd have, and be repurposing part of the time of two people who also will retain some duties within the Bureau. That's another piece going back to not just having people disappear forever, but two people over there working a lot of time there, some of their time with us. We'd keep them housed with us, but so they're working over under the FBI supervision on those investigations and reporting to a current lieutenant that we already have. So there would be no additional lieutenant as a part of that.
And my understanding, sir, is that you currently have the requisite security clearance?
Yes, sir.
And that is?
Secret clearance.
Thank you.
So how does that proposed level of staffing compare with the staffing that you've been dedicating to the task force over the last year?
We've had two people that whenever we would do things, we would look at using those folks.
So we've had two officers participating for the past year.
We've had two officers working under the current arrangement.
Available to participate.
Yeah.
And can you tell me how much they have participated over the last year?
That's the subject of the report that we've been discussing at length that has caused us so many problems.
So the answer to that question is no, you can't tell.
I think it's permissible to say very little.
It's a secret.
I think it's safe for me to say very little.
That's the problem.
So what would the off? What are we using? We're not having additional officers. I know how much overtime you currently are facing, and that you are not you don't have a high number of officers per number of citizens anyway. So what would these officers, where would they be pulled from?
They would be repurposed from officers doing duty that we already have.
Right. So that means that they would not be doing traffic duty, or they would not be doing what kinds of things would they not do because they would be participating full time in the task force?
They would not be doing a different investigative type of work that they might otherwise be doing. This isn't going to be pulling a blue suit patrol officer off of the street.
So other investigations would be shorter of manpower, woman power, than because these officers would be full time.
Certainly.
Mr. Novick?
This is probably a question for Dave, although Chief would be interested in your take too. But one of the features of the Attorney General's guidelines that the ACLU points to is, quote, these guidelines do not authorize investigating or collecting or maintaining information on United States persons solely for the purpose of monitoring activities protected by the First Amendment or the lawful exercise of other rights secured by the Constitution or laws of the United States. And the ACLU points to the word solely and says, well, does that mean that you can investigate or maintain information on United States persons where 95% of the reason is simply their exercise of their First Amendment rights? I mean, what's the significance of that word solely to you?
You need to read that word in context of the whole regulatory scheme. And the federal government has an extensive system of categorizing investigations by their intrusiveness, by how long they've continued, by how strong the interest, the law enforcement interest, in other words, the criminal predicate is. And there are some that start with very low threat information, but indications, it's required that there be indications that the investigators are actually pursuing criminal activity that has or will occur. Then that balance is continually measured by their oversight system. Cases do not survive if the system works as it should, do not survive unless the criminal investigatory interests or the terrorism interests, which are quite similar, are increasingly substantial. And certainly intrusive, there's a whole set of rules for when the investigators can apply more intrusive investigative techniques. I mean, for instance, at a low level of criminal predicate, open source, the front page of the paper, for instance, open source internet information can be gathered by investigators. It's not very intrusive. To start using warrants, go into homes, wiretaps, that sort of thing require a concurrence of prosecutors, judges, and an evaluation that the case is worth the intrusion. So it varies. It can start, again, with a very low level of concern. The example that I've heard about for years that seems to kind of bring these issues together is observations by, say, a marine owner in Portland of someone who's taking cameras out and shooting photographs of our bridges. You know, it could be terrible. It could be nothing. And the rules are set up, at least in the federal system, to allow some level of investigation, low level of intrusiveness. So it's a delicate balance at each stage, and the regulatory overlay recognizes that. So solely can be, you can end up with some pretty small criminal predicate. The question is, as a policy matter, what do you apply as an investigative technique given the small criminal predicate?
My husband used to take pictures of bridges quite a lot, and he sometimes was stopped and asked why he was taking pictures of bridges with a very long photo lens. So that's an example of an activity which many people would not think might have a criminal nexus, but potentially could. Is that a good translation?
Yes. Thank you.
A similar question, this again is from the ACLU's, quoting the 2010 Inspector General's report, where they say, the purpose test for attending public events under Part 6 of the 2002 Attorney General Guidelines did not require any demonstration of an articulable suspicion to attend the event. It simply required that the agent ordering the activity have an anti-terrorism purpose in mind, end quote. So, I mean, some people feel that even if they're at a public event, if somebody's there to, you know, quote, spy on them, they still feel they're spied on, even though it's a public event. This sort of seems like the FBI can attend any public event just because they think they're fighting terrorism. Is that, I mean, how would you read that language?
I've seen that presentation by the ACLU, and it's one of the slides they presented in the past. We might see it today. On its face, yes, the ACLU asserts that that is not strict enough. It isn't a very firm or strict line. I can't speak with authority to the whole federal structure. I have a general sense of it. But if you had an officer who wanted to attend a rally and went to a supervisor in the federal system for approval, I don't know what that process would look like, that approval process. That's too deep into it for me with my kind of sophomoric knowledge reading through the Attorney General's guidelines.
Other questions for our team here from the city? Thank you all very much. Appreciate that. Now we're going to call on a panel on one side of the issue. That is a panel that believes that we should proceed to join the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And that panel consists of our U.S. Attorney, Amanda Marshall, Bill Williams from the U.S. Attorney's Office, and Bill Barr from the Citizens Crime Commission. So please come up, and thank you very much for being with us this evening. Good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor and members of the council. I want to start by just thanking all of you for the opportunity to address you today. And I know you've been working really hard on this issue individually and doing your homework, because we've been talking to you and providing you any information you've asked for. And I really appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you have been approaching this problem. It was a difficult decision for me to decide to come, because I am not an elected official or a politician, but I am a representative of federal law enforcement. So one of my real concerns is not to politicize this issue or make it about personalities, but simply to be able to publicly provide the facts that I think would support this decision to join the JTTF moving forward to protect the citizens of Portland. I've been asked to address a few issues, so I've framed my remarks around those in the interest of providing the Commission with the information you requested. I actually grouped the first three, because I think the answer covers really three of your questions, and those are: how will this support the JTTF mission? How will it enhance Portland Police Bureau generally? And what are the drawbacks of the current system being not involved on a day-to-day basis? I do want to start with the third, though, to just clarify that from the position of the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the U.S. Attorney's Office, there is no half in and half out. There is in or out. And to be in, you have to be a signatory to the FBI MOU. So the resolution that was passed in 2011, which some have referred to as partway in, isn't binding on the FBI or the federal government, of course, as a city resolution, but was really more a framework, as we view it, for the city to move forward and how the city manages Portland Police Bureau's participation in terrorism investigations, since they were not members of the JTTF. So that's just sort of a rhetorical framing, but I think it's significant. So the answer, to group those questions and really go through the answers: how it makes the JTTF better, how it makes Portland Police better, and how it will take away drawbacks from the current system. You know, initially, because counterterrorism is the FBI's number one priority, every field office in the country has a joint terrorism task force made up of federal agents and local law enforcement officers. Portland is the only major metropolitan city in the United States whose city police force has opted out of that partnership. And it shouldn't be anyone's part-time job, not in Portland or anywhere, to make sure our city is safe from terrorist threats. The first sign of a terrorist threat in Portland, as it has been in the past, likely will not be spotted by an FBI agent or related to the FBI's gathering of intelligence. It will more likely be a local police officer or sheriff's deputy who will be in a position to observe and respond to a citizen complaint. The relationship through full-time active participation in the task force is vital to connecting those dots. Face-to-face daily contact with an embedded task force officer gives them real-time, constant access to intelligence and investigations. It helps to connect thousands of dots between Portland Police Bureau's thousands of street and citizen contacts and the FBI's thousands of intel contacts. We know that in all spheres, modern-day law enforcement is about partnerships and relationships. And you heard Chief O'Day talk about some of those partnerships and relationships that exist and thrive between the City of Portland and the FBI, including the Metro Gangs Task Force, the Bank Robbery Task Force, and the Child Exploitation Task Force. Those are all FBI task forces, and Portland Police has acknowledged and benefited from the relationships in all of those cases to keep our community safe. Portland loses out on day-to-day investigative steps if they're not in the task force, and they also lose out on one more layer of oversight and enhanced transparency between what federal law enforcement and local law enforcement are doing. At the time of the 9/11 attacks on this nation, the City of New York was the primary JTTF in the country. The City of New York PD had been embedded with the FBI for some time. After 9/11, with the acknowledgement that intelligence information had been siloed between federal and state and local law enforcement agencies and the risk that that posed to our nation and our communities, the JTTFs were ordered to be put in place in every field office of the FBI across the nation for the purpose of not creating more walls and silos, but for opening up that information to people like the City of Portland, in order to better connect your communities. So it's really more of an openness and transparency. It not only gives more oversight to the Portland police officers in terms of the layers and layers and layers of oversight that your city attorney discussed and that are contained in literally thousands of pages of documents located throughout the federal government and different policies, but also gives the Portland Police oversight into what the FBI is doing directly through your TFOs, your task force officers, who will be reporting straight up your chain of command all the way to the police commissioner so that you know what it is the FBI is doing in your city in a way you would not know were you not members of the JTTF. The JTTF is not just about detecting and managing threats, but it's also about prevention, response, and apprehension. And one need not look no forward than the terrible tragedy that happened at the Boston Marathon to see how well these relationships work in a time of crisis. Yes, that attack was not prevented, but the outcome of the investigation would not and could not have been successful without the strong partnership between the Boston Police Department and the FBI's JTTF. Carmen Ortiz was here, the U.S. attorney from Boston recently, and I know, Mayor, you had a chance to meet with her with some of your staff, and some of your staff attended a briefing that she did for my anti-terrorism council. And she really highlighted how, because of the relationship and the embeddedness of the Boston Police with the JTTF, they were able to gather intelligence information, lock down the city, keep people safe, determine who the suspects were, and bring them into custody in a more expeditious way, in a safer way, in a more effective way than ever would have been done without that relationship. An example of that is that the Boston police officers were aware of every single poll camera in the city that the FBI had, and so they knew exactly how to access that information and utilize it in their investigation in real time, right at the time of the bombing. That's just an example of the type of intel and investigative partnership and technique that allowed them to coordinate in order to apprehend those suspects. I was asked what the current threat is now compared to in previous years. The FBI and collaboration between state and local and federal law enforcement goes back in time, way before Portland even had a JTTF. Many years ago, there were that type of task force and collaboration led to apprehension of a suspect and successful prosecution of somebody who lit a Portland abortion clinic on fire. So, you know, you can go back to times like that. That would be an example of a type of investigation that even today, if it were to occur in Portland, they would be able to work together on. We've always had here in Oregon a large presence of folks who refer to themselves as sovereign citizens. Those are other types of investigations that are still going on. We have threats here in Oregon to this day. That's been a pretty consistent threat in terms of domestic security, white supremacist groups and others as well. But in the last, and we all know about 9/11 and the threat of Al-Qaeda, but in the last 5 to 10 years, it has changed from just Al-Qaeda. We have people acting alone and getting radicalized on the internet. We have homegrown extremists, lone wolves, and we have people from Oregon who are traveling overseas to Syria and other parts of the Middle East to fight with ISIS and ISIL. And the scary thing is what happens when they come back. After France, the nature of the attacks are smaller, they're easier to organize, and they're harder to detect and disrupt. The Willamette Week published some cartoons a few weeks ago that Charlie Hebdo was attacked for publishing. So it's not just Paris. Those types of threats exist in our city as well. We have people in Portland who are troubled and lost. They're looking for meaning and direction, and they are vulnerable. And the challenge that we face in law enforcement is that they may be getting exposed to radicalization and calls to violence on the internet. And after prolonged exposure to that sort of poison, they may get up from the computer and kill people, which is the call of ISIL, just kill somebody. There are open cases looking into individuals who may be related to ISIL or ISIS in every state in this country, with the exception of Alaska. I was also asked to highlight the process by which the JTTF opens new cases, and your city attorney addressed some of that, so I hope this isn't too repetitive. I do want to tell you that there is a manual that is utilized by the FBI and that covers a lot of this, and it's thousands of pages, and there's also lots of other policy, and it's embedded in a lot of other sections of the law, depending on the nature of the investigation and the techniques that are used. But generally, just to summarize it, there are three stages. The first is a threat assessment. When something comes in, there's this threshold question. At that stage, you can't do much. So, Commissioner Fritz, you know, if your husband's out taking pictures of Portland's beautiful bridges, which I'm sure many people do, and why wouldn't they, the FBI or the JTTF or task force officer doesn't have a right to tap his phone. They may have the right to say, hey, why are you taking those pictures? So that's the type of low-level contact that is allowed under the first phase of the investigation, which is the threat assessment. Is there anything wrong? And in the vast majority of these cases, the answer is no. They say, nice to see you, have a nice day, and enjoy your photos. But as that threat escalates, then the investigation and the techniques that can be used can escalate. But while it's designated as only a threat assessment, there's very little that law enforcement can do at that stage. Open source data, conversation, things of that nature. The second stage, and again, this is only after intensive review by lawyers, by people within the FBI, following their own procedures about when it can be escalated from a threat assessment to a preliminary investigation, is the preliminary investigation. This is where additional investigative techniques are available, such as grand jury subpoenas. So again, now you've got the oversight of the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the grand jury is another threat on a case that's moved into this level of investigation that would allow these techniques to be used. This is also the stage at which they may be authorized to interview people in a more formal setting. And these cases, once designated as preliminary investigations, are reviewed every 90 days to determine if the case should move forward or closed. And they're supposed to be, if they haven't moved forward, then the rule says they're closed in 6 months. Unless there's another review and they determine it should be extended as if it was a new investigation. I want to give you an example of the way that this works in real practice with the JTTF and investigations that I've been personally aware of here in Portland. Most of these cases, again, are going to be closed. So these are the cases where they see the guy with the camera and they engage in mere conversation with him, or look at open source documents to determine whether there's anything that would indicate that there's some threat. Maybe they call over to Chief O'Day and he checks with the behavioral health unit to find out if this is maybe an individual that has mental health issues that they're already addressing in another way, which would be, you know, which would be helpful to know in terms of what follow-up should take place. And in a case, in some of the cases that I've seen, in many of the cases I've seen, most of the cases, people are diverted and the case is closed. But the FBI engages in citizen engagement to try to turn people around when they can. That's always the first point of action. They don't need cases that, they don't need more to do. They don't need to make somebody a terrorist who's not. But if somebody's on that borderline, the vulnerable people that we talk about who are who could be radicalized, they try to get them turned in the right direction. And that includes such things as FBI terrorism agents reaching out to universities to help a kid get back in school because he's lost his way, and they know if they can just get him connected back with his community and back on the right track, maybe he can turn it around. Because there's nothing illegal about looking at radicalizing propaganda on the internet. That is protected by the First Amendment. And mere speech alone does not justify a criminal investigation or prosecution. So they are very careful to try to disrupt and dissuade whenever possible, even if it means doing things that you might not think about FBI agents doing, like going to talk to school administrators or talking to somebody's employer or reaching out to community support, mental health support, contacting up with the BHU to try to find out what resources they have, local mental health, to try to steer somebody off of the path of terrorism. And that happens a lot in the phase two. Phase three is a full-blown active investigation. Very few of these are opened. Additional techniques can be used, for example, search warrants or tracker devices like your city attorney discussed. But at each level and with each additional technique, there's more intrusive review and more oversight. For example, obviously, if you wanted to tap somebody's phone, that has to go to a federal judge, and you have to get a warrant, which requires a application about this big to support, and then judicial oversight, in addition to the oversight by the U.S. Attorney's Office, by the Criminal Division of Maine Justice back in Washington, D.C., and by several others. So with each technique, there's additional oversight, additional requirements, and I think that's important to highlight. Now, the next question was, how are civil rights protected?
Before you move on from that, could you just explain that oversight by the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office,
sure.
The oversight at the FBI? What's your role in the, and do your staff
sure.
participate in the JTTF?
Absolutely. So, yes, we do participate in the JTTF. I do have clearance, as do many people in my office. Mr. Williams, who's here with me, who until today was my criminal chief and is now my first assistant. He has clearance and participates in the JTTF. We have a unit in my office that's the anti-terrorism unit, national security unit, and all of the prosecutors in that unit have clearance and participate in the JTTF. But particularly my national security prosecutors, of which we have four and a half, they go to the FBI. They spend time at the FBI field office. They review investigations. The Department of Justice, so anything that the FBI wants to do or the JTTF officers need to do that would require any type of technique that, that the Constitution or federal law requires judicial involvement or grand jury, we have to sign off on and review and be briefed on. So any grand jury subpoena, any Title III wire, any tracker device, anything like that is going to be reviewed and signed off on by a prosecutor. And in some of those matters, a federal judge is going to be involved as well. In addition, my terrorism folks are working in conjunction with the JTTF on a regular basis on all of their cases.
They're watching to make sure that the participants in the JTTF are doing their job the way that the laws require.
Absolutely, and I would say that recently that oversight and involvement has actually substantially increased, and that's a result of a policy directive that was issued by Attorney General Eric Holder to all U.S. attorneys directing us to create a risk assessment tool and to work with our special agents in charge and assistant special agents in charge of all of our federal law enforcement partners so that we early